Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Just note for purposes of the recording that today is May 28th. We do have 5 cases on our calendar today, 3 oral cases and 2 non-oral cases. I'm just going to take a minute to get organized here and then we'll get going. So the first case on our calendar today is A24-1547, State of Minnesota versus Deshawn Rashi Stevenson. If I mispronounce the name of appellant, please, counsel, feel free to correct me. The counsel will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. As you know, the podium is adjustable, so feel free to adjust it, and there is a clock showing the time on the podium. So with that, we can proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Julia Brady, and I represent appellant Deshawn Stevenson in this case. On the morning of October 7th, 2022, State Trooper Caldwell pulled Mr. Stevenson over for speeding. When Mr. Stevenson could not produce a driver's license, the trooper, without further questioning or investigation, directed him into the back of the squad car. When Mr. Stevenson asked if he had to, the trooper responded affirmatively. Minnesota case law is clear. The inability of a minor traffic violator to produce a driver's license by itself is not a reasonable basis for confining that driver in the back of a squad car.
When you say confining, the door is open, though, correct?
Yes, the door was open, Your Honor. However, Mr. Stevenson was still confined in the back of that squad car for 2 specific reasons. Primarily, it was a verbal confinement here. He actually asked if he had to comply with these orders, if he had to go and sit in the back of the squad car, and the trooper said yes, he did. In that situation, a reasonable person would not have believed that they were free to disregard the trooper's orders, or once they were placed in the back of that squad car, they would not believe that they were free to leave. The second reason why there is a confinement here is just that the back of a squad car inherently carries some, I would say, psychological idea that somebody is in trouble and that somebody cannot leave, that they are under police direction at that point. Minnesota case law is clear. As I stated, the inability of a minor traffic violator to produce a driver's license is not a reasonable basis for confining that driver in the back of the squad car. So under this state's precedent, Trooper Caldwell unconstitutionally expanded the scope of the traffic stop when he directed Mr. Stevenson into the back of the squad car and subject Mr. Stevenson to an unreasonable and warrantless seizure.
The officer can legally ask him to get out of his vehicle with
yes,
a
Your
stop,
Honor.
Right?
Yes.
So if we change the facts, and let's say this is now February, mm-hmm. and it's minus 30, the officer can say, get out of the car, stand right next to my squad car vehicle here while I check my computer. And here it was raining a bit. So why wouldn't putting the person in the car be both safer for the individual and the officer and just to get out of the weather?
You are correct, and I do believe that a situation that would have been more reasonable here, that would have still achieved the government interest of accurately identifying Mr. Stevenson while not intruding too much on his rights, would have been to just have him stand next to the squad car, either in front of or off to the side on the grass, so he was not in the path of oncoming traffic. That would have been fine. However, because there was a reasonable alternative that led to less of an intrusion on my client's rights, you know, an intrusion by the government, placing him in that squad car where he didn't have the opportunity to leave. He had been told he can't disobey this order. And just like I said, the back of a squad car carries a connotation that somebody is in trouble. That is an additional intrusion into my client's rights. And State versus Askaruth and many other cases from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court are clear that every incremental intrusion into a person's rights by the government needs to be justified by reasonable suspicion as articulated in Terry. And here, the reason why that extra step of confining Mr. Stevenson in the back, like I said, is there are other ways to achieve what he needed to achieve that would not have caused, you know, undue harm or challenges to the government. And in terms of the weather specifically, there is a case, and I'm blanking on the case name. I can find it. I believe it was potentially... I'll find it on rebuttal, unfortunately, but there was a specific case where an officer pulled somebody back into the front seat of a squad car because it was very cold, and this court determined that that was not a legitimate reason for bringing somebody into a squad car. That was seen as essentially officer comfort or officer convenience. And
so in this case, the record, the video shows rain, and the district court found that rain was part of the reasoning for making the expansion of putting the Mr. Stevenson in the back of the car reasonable. Can you address the rain factor in this case?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. There was no visibility obstruction in this situation, even though it was raining. And when you watch the video, at least my interpretation of that video is the rain was very light and was not causing any, it had just started, so the roads were not yet slippery, and there was no, like I said, no visibility obstruction by the rain. It was also the morning, so the sun was out, so there were no issues with being in the dark here. And so I believe that that rain issue goes to this idea that officer safety, or the district court found that officer safety justifies putting Mr. Stevenson back in the back of that squad car, and I don't believe that that is the correct analysis. I believe the district court erred when it concluded that.
And what was the reasonable alternative here?
I can think of three different reasonable alternatives here to achieve the government's interest in accurately identifying Mr. Stevenson. The first, as I already addressed, is having Mr. Stevenson stand either in front of the squad car or over to the side so he's further away from traffic. In the rain, yes. However,
just clarifying.
Yes. Like I said, it's inconvenient, but at least it's not, I would say it's uncomfortable for the defendant, but that is not something that courts generally factor in when determining if an officer's actions are reasonable or not. So the first one is having the defendant stand outside. The second is bringing the defendant with, Trooper Caldwell goes with the defendant to the side of the road on the grassy patch so they're further away from traffic and has that conversation there and then goes back to his squad car. And the third, which I think is probably what most officers would do, is taking the name from Mr. Stevenson on the side of the road, leaving Mr. Stevenson in his car, going back to the squad car, looking him up. And if there's any indication there that maybe the name that he gave doesn't match or the picture doesn't match Mr. Stevenson, at that point what's happened is another reasonable suspicion of a different criminal act has occurred. So if there is a situation where Mr. Stevenson is still in his car and Trooper Caldwell is not 100% sure that the name he gave is accurate, you now have reasonable articulable suspicion of potentially giving a police officer a false name. And in that situation, Trooper Caldwell may have been justified in bringing Mr. Stevenson back to sit in the back of his car. What he did here was he just took Mr. Stevenson into the back of his car exclusively based on the fact that he didn't have the ability to produce a license. And he testified at the evidentiary hearing that his sole basis for bringing Mr. Stevenson back in that moment was because he didn't have a license, and that just goes directly against State versus Askaruth.
So Askaruth does have some pretty clear language that lack of a driver's license by itself is not a reasonable basis for confining a driver in a squad car's locked back seat mm-hmm. when the driver is stopped for a minor traffic offense. Here, the car door was open, and there wasn't a pat-down search. Do those facts provide a basis for distinguishing this case from Askaruth and the holding in that case?
No, Your Honor. Factually, there are some distinguishing aspects to this case in Askruth. However, it doesn't impact the fact that the holding in Askruth should still apply here. I would argue that the important aspect of Askruth is not that the back seat was closed or locked. It was that he was confined, as I already discussed. And that is something that this court has, you know, post-Askruth in a lot of non-precedential cases, has essentially said, you know, Askruth isn't supposed to be read so literally that the holding is just that you can't put somebody in a locked back seat. The idea there is that you have to balance the government's interest with the person's right to be free from government interference. And in a situation where the only potential issue is that somebody can't produce a driver's license, the government interest, the only, I guess I'll just quote from Askruth here, the court in Askruth concluded that there's no suggestion that confining Askruth in the back seat was the only means reasonably available to accomplish the government interest. And I think that's the part of Askruth here that also applies with Mr. Stevenson's case, where there were other aspects that led to less of an intrusion on Mr. Stevenson's rights that were the trooper could have accomplished the exact same thing here, which was doing that side-by-side comparison.
Is there ever a scenario where an officer can put somebody in the back seat, leave the door open like they did here? You know, let's say it's a blizzard. Would that be a situation where they could say, you know, why don't you get in the back of the car?
I think, yes, I could come up with a factual situation where a person was in a situation like that. I mean, I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. So, you know, if there is a blizzard or say maybe we're in a polar vortex and it's, you know, negative 20, 30 degrees, then you have a situation where the weather is not just an inconvenience. You have a situation where the weather is potentially causing safety issues to both the officer and the person who's being pulled over. However, I do believe that under Askruth, you know, something that would potentially has to happen there if the only issue is the lack of a driver's license, you would have to make sure that the defendant was aware or the person was aware that they had a choice. If the only issue is that they can't produce a driver's license and there is maybe a weather convenience issue there, the person would be safe staying in their car. The trooper would be safe in their car looking something up. So in your example, if there's a weather safety issue and they said, hey, you know, you have the right to stay in your car, but it would be a lot more convenient and safer for both of us if I brought you back into the squad car and we had this conversation, would you be willing to do that? I think that's a situation where that would be okay, and primarily because at that point they're not confined because they've been given a choice. And here I will say that Trooper Caldwell did not ever tell appellant that he was free to go, and I think any reasonable person would not have felt free to go in that situation. If Mr. Stevenson had gotten out of the backseat of the car and started to walk back towards his car, I think you have a situation where now you're disobeying police officer orders, and that potentially carries other criminal implications. So along with circling back just briefly to officer safety, one of the reasons that Trooper Caldwell gave both to Mr. Stevenson directly and to the district court was that he had a general practice of not taking names on the side of the road because of an experience that he had with somebody else he arrested. He arrested somebody for a DUI. He didn't take their name on the side of the road, and that person said to him, you know, if you had looked down to write my name down, I was planning to shoot you. And because of that, he now has this general practice. The issue here is that when you're looking at reasonable articulable suspicion, that has to be particularized and individualized to the person that is having that encounter with law enforcement. So a general practice of not taking names on the side of the road is exactly the opposite of what's allowed under our current case law when it comes to stop expansions. And Trooper Caldwell did testify at the evidentiary hearing that he did not believe that Mr. or he had no reason to believe that Mr. Stevenson was armed or dangerous. And that is evidenced by his actions when he didn't frisk Mr. Stevenson and put him into the back of the car. So it's not, Trooper Caldwell was not legally allowed in a situation like this to impute his one encounter with somebody onto everybody else he now meets, especially Mr. Stevenson here, when there was no potential evidence showing that Mr. Stevenson was a threat to Trooper Caldwell.
Counsel, you mentioned case law that allows, that says even putting a person in the front seat is a distinction without a difference. But I think you stated that most of those cases are non-precedential. Are you aware of any precedential cases that have said that? Because I know there are a number, Flynn and others.
I am not aware of that. I believe that the strongest or most of the case law that has been, that has followed Askaruth is non-precedential case law primarily. And I will say, I think that that goes to the fact that this court hasn't issued a precedential case and the Supreme Court hasn't taken up review on any of those cases goes to the fact that the interpretation of this court of Askaruth is likely the correct interpretation in terms of what the Supreme Court meant, in the sense that Askaruth was not meant to be a floor of what is considered reasonable. They're not saying that everything's reasonable up until the point you lock somebody in the back of the squad car. If you take that holding and interpret it how this court has in non-precedential case law, it's a little bit broader than that, and it's looking at this balancing of when is somebody confined versus what is the government interest that's trying to be achieved here. So I'm not aware of precedential case law in that way. However, I think that that in and of itself shows that that's kind of how Askaruth should be interpreted.
The state has an alternative argument about even if this seizure was invalid, mm-hmm. that the false name was not as a result of the unreasonable seizure. Can you address that?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Your Honor. The state has forfeited this argument, essentially has forfeited its right to make this argument that even if the stop was unlawful, the evidence should still come in, primarily because they stipulated this case is in front of this court right now based on a stipulation under Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2601, Subdivision 4. And in that, under that rule, both parties have stipulated that the pretrial issue is dispositive. And when you look at the district court's order, it's very clear that the only issue that the district court was addressing was whether or not the stop expansion was lawful. There was absolutely no analysis in the district court's order, but also no discussion by the parties in front of the district court. May I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you. There was no discussion about any type of, exception to the exclusionary rule. Parties are not required, the state is not required to agree to a stipulation in this case, but it is my argument, it's our argument that the state cannot bring this kind of exception idea in front of this court due to the stipulation.
I have one follow-up question for you. Did you make that argument in your reply brief?
I did not, Your Honor. I did address the stipulation aspect of the facts, and I did drop a footnote that the state had not
raised. I see the footnote.
Yes.
Okay. But you didn't make this detailed argument.
Yes,
in your
that is true.
Brief.
And I would say that I stand by my reply brief in the sense that even if this court decides that the state hasn't forfeited the argument about exceptions to the exclusionary rule, the analysis in the reply brief stands, and this statement would be purely speculative, so any type of inevitable discovery situation wouldn't apply.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Lindsay Danielson, and I'm an assistant city attorney for the city of Minneapolis. I'm appearing here today on behalf of respondent State of Minnesota. Here, respondent respectfully requests this court affirm the district court's denial of appellant's motion to suppress. I'm making that request for two reasons. First, there was not an illegal seizure here. Askaruth, which was relied on heavily by appellant, does not compel this court to hold that there was a constitutional violation in this case. However, even if this court does hold that there was an illegal seizure, this court should still hold that the motion to suppress was properly denied because the exclusionary rule does not apply here. So first, there was not an illegal seizure, and Trooper Caldwell acted reasonably when he asked appellant to step out of his vehicle and move to the back of the squad car. In Askaruth, it explains that incremental intrusions during a traffic stop need to be tied to the legitimate purpose of the stop or to reasonableness or independent probable cause. Here, the intrusion of asking appellant to step to the back of the squad car was tied to the legitimate purpose of the traffic stop because that is what needed to happen in order for Trooper Caldwell to accurately and reliably identify appellant as the driver.
Well, couldn't the officer have just asked him to stand next to the squad car or in front of the squad car and it would achieve the same purpose?
By having appellant sit in the back of the squad car, it gave Trooper Caldwell the best vantage point to perform a side-by-side comparison. And that side-by-side comparison was important, and he testified to this at the hearing so that he could make an accurate and a reliable identification.
But why is it different if he's just outside the window versus he's turning around to look at the guy where the computer screen's right in front of him?
I suppose it's not different, but there's also there's no difference in the intrusion at that point either because...
But isn't there a difference in the intrusion if the individual is placed in the back of the squad car after they ask, do I have to go in the squad car? And the officer says yes.
There is, but also the squad car door was left open. In the body cam video, the appellant is seen facing out of the passenger side of the squad car. He's on the phone, his phone call is audible. He's saying to somebody on the other end of the line, I was pulled over. I might need you to come pick me up. I don't think it's a big deal. He knew that he was not under arrest. He felt free to leave. He wouldn't have made those statements otherwise.
He was free to leave. Why did the officer, when he asked him, the officer said no. Based on the conversation that they had, how would a reasonable person thought that they were free to leave?
Well, he wasn't free to leave the encounter entirely, but Trooper Caldwell did testify, and it's on page 35 of the testimony, that had appellant said he wasn't comfortable and wanted to step out, that Trooper Caldwell would have let him do so.
But that's not supported by the conversation that they had before he put him in the back of the squad car, though.
That's true. It's not supported.
And he just... This is his standard practice.
It is his standard practice, and that's what he testified to, but also he testified to reasons that were specific to this case. He testified about the traffic conditions at the time of day when this traffic stop was performed, how there was a lot of traffic. It was situated on a curve where drivers travel quickly without regard to the traffic stops, and that's actually visible in the video. On the body cam, you can see a car in the far right lane zip past the traffic stop without slowing down and without moving over. So there are safety conditions that are specific to this case that support the legitimate government interest of having him pulled out in the car to identify him.
Which is why troopers oftentimes will approach a car from the passenger side.
Yes, correct.
So why couldn't the appellant here be pulled over to the side of the road?
I'm not going to speculate, Your Honor, but I do know that Trooper Caldwell did state these reasons on the record, but another really important reason here, and this is a huge difference from Askaruth. In Askaruth, the main and the only reason that was provided by the state for removing Mr. Askaruth from the car to identify him was for officer convenience, and that is not one of the reasons here. Here we have safety reasons. Trooper Caldwell testified to that, and the district court made that finding. We also have the necessity of performing a side-by-side comparison of the driver and the photo of whosever name Trooper Caldwell was pulling up so he could see who the driver actually was, and that is a legitimate state interest.
Well, a side-by-side comparison, as Judge Schmidt pointed out, it seems like that would be better if the officer is sitting in the squad car and they've got the computer here, side by side would probably be if the person was just right outside the squad car versus, you know, looking back and checking, trying to see whether or not the images actually matched.
He was in close proximity, and that's what was important. Trooper Caldwell testified about the need and the importance of not having to memorize a face, especially if a name that he pulls up in his system looks similar to the driver, but is not sure. It actually prevented walking back and forth, and ultimately I believe it shortened the duration of the traffic stop by having him in the back.
I was just going to say, isn't that part of police training to be able to identify people? I mean, they are, and particularly in tense situations, that's part of their training, is to be able to identify people's features and height, weight, facial features, whether they have hair, their color, race, ethnicity. That's part of their training, to be able to, you know, spot those really quickly. I mean, it seems counterintuitive to what a police officer's job is.
I can't speak to the exact training, but what I can speak to is the reason that was stated on the record and the finding that was made in the court's order that goes to the legitimate government interest of identifying the driver so Trooper Caldwell could enforce the traffic laws and issue a citation.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the district court, the trooper said the sole reason why he asked Stevenson to go to the squad car was because he did not have a valid driver's license or photo ID, and he wanted to be able to do a comparison. Isn't that the convenience that was identified in Askaruth?
No, Your Honor, because in Askaruth, the officer said he didn't want to have to walk back and forth between Mr. Askaruth's car and his own squad car.
But for purposes of identifying the individual, correct?
I mean, yes, but it was a convenience issue in Askaruth, and here, although it may have been more convenient for Trooper Caldwell, the reason for having to do the side-by-side comparison was not for convenience, but to be able to make an accurate and reliable identification of the driver.
Isn't that the same thing? Askaruth seems awfully on point here. Isn't that for the convenience of the officer doesn't have to look at the photo on his computer, and then if he's not sure, then go back to the car to look, is that actually the same person or not? Isn't that officer convenience?
I mean, it may be officer convenience, but that's not the primary reason, Your Honor. The primary reason is to perform his job, enforce the traffic laws, and make a reliable identification of the driver.
Could also the officer have taken a photo of the picture that he pulled up on his computer on his cell phone and taken it over and compared it to the individual while the individual remained in their car?
I suppose.
We're looking at reasonableness here.
Sure.
Correct? So,
and I think the reasonableness question goes far beyond, like, why he was pulled out of the car, but also looking at what happened in the car. There were 7 minutes that passed that appellant sat in the car until he was arrested for providing a false name. And in Askaruth, Mr. Askaruth was placed in the car, and then Officer Schmidt called for a backup officer. That didn't happen here. And then Officer Schmidt asked for consent to search Askaruth's car, and it wasn't until after backup officers arrived, until after the consent search was complete, that Officer Schmidt issued those citations and allowed him to go. And so we're talking about a huge difference in time, and the Askaruth detention was significantly more intrusive than the intrusion here, which consisted of asking one question that Trooper Caldwell was entitled to ask regardless of where appellant was sitting.
Would you agree with appellant that appellant's counsel that appellant was confined when he was put in the back of the squad car?
I do not agree with that.
And why not?
In Askaruth, there were multiple intrusions. So first in Askaruth, he was removed from his vehicle. Then he was placed in the squad car. The squad car doors were shut. And then another intrusion, the squad car doors were locked. Here, the squad car doors were neither shut nor were they locked. On the video, it appears that appellant is sitting inside the squad car, but like his feet are partially outside. and he was on the phone. He was not confined.
So you're pointing to the physical location of appellant, but I think counsel argued that he was confined because the officer told him he had to be in the car, that he didn't have a choice after he asked, do I have to go in the car? And the officer said, yes, he had to. And that amounted to confinement.
Well, I would respond that under that line of reasoning, he would have also been confined if he had been told to stand just outside the squad car and not allowed to leave. He would have been confined if he had been told to stand outside his own car. He's still not allowed to leave. The confinement didn't happen because he was physically inside a squad car.
But he had been told he had to go to the back of the squad car.
Correct. But he was never...
different than being outside.
Sure,
but... And that goes to the reasonableness.
It does. But here it was reasonable, and I think it's really important to look at the balancing test. The government interest here, there were two. There was safety, but there was also the need to accurately and reliably identify the driver. And that is a substantial, it's a significant government interest, and it's been recognized by this court and by other courts. Here, on the other hand, the intrusion was minimal. There were no enhanced interrogation techniques. He was not subject to any sort of line of questioning. This is nothing like Ask Ruth and the duration and the intrusion that took place in that case.
Do you have any cases on point that affirmed where somebody's put in the back of a squad car for a lack of a license or lack of insurance?
Your Honor, I believe, and I'm not... No, I'm going to say I don't recall one right now. I don't want to miscite a case.
I agree with you. It seems to me that your argument's based on distinguishing Askaruth, Fernando, and the non-precedential cases like Desroches, which is the one counsel was mentioning before about the weather. As an error-correcting court, if we don't have anything directly on point saying, yeah, that's okay, and everything's saying, no, actually, putting somebody in the back of the squad is not okay, isn't the distinctions that you're making here better for the Supreme Court to resolve with the door open and on a cell phone?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and I think it's because the differences between our case and Askruth are so significant that Askruth doesn't compel this court to find that there was an illegal seizure to begin with.
But even the cases that have, they're non-precedential from this court, but when an officer has put a person in the front seat, we have said repeatedly that's a distinction without a difference, even though in the front seat it's a little bit more casual. You don't have the window, you don't have the doors that you can't open, anything like that. And yet we have said that's still in violation of their rights as well.
If the court is speaking about State versus Vernado, which is the case that comes to mind, the facts in that case were so different here that it wouldn't be dispositive in this case either, because in that case there was a pat-down. Drugs were found during that pat-down, and the motion to suppress was to keep the drugs out of evidence. I know I'm out of time, and so I have just brief closing comments. But the state does respectfully request this court affirm the district court's denial of the motion to suppress, first, because there was not an illegal seizure. But second, if this court does find that there was an illegal seizure and the state is not conceding that point, respondent would respectfully request this court hold that the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule does not apply because but-for causation is not established, and because the evidence that appellant is seeking to suppress was sufficiently attenuated by intervening circumstances to make the exclusionary rule inapplicable here. And just last but not least, the case that I was relying on for the attenuation doctrine is State v. Engle. It's this court's opinion from earlier this week, or excuse me, earlier this year, 18 Northwest 2nd, 540. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I have a few brief points I'd like to address. The first is that when evaluating whether a warrantless seizure is reasonable, what we look at is the facts available to the officer at the point that that stop expansion or that potential warrantless seizure occurred. So when we're looking at, we cannot consider, this court should not consider the contents of Mr. Stevenson's phone call and what he said, because at that point he had already been seized, and the issue is whether or not that seizure was unconstitutional. Second, I would like to say that I would like to address the idea that being confined outside of the car or being made to stand outside of the car is the same type of confinement as being made to sit in the car. And this goes back to the idea that reasonableness, as articulated in Terry, which is what we're looking at, is a balancing test. And in that situation, yes, Mr. Stevenson would be confined in the sense that he would not be free to leave if he was asked to stand out beside the car. However, the intrusion there is less. There is the intrusion feels less invasive, having somebody stand out in the open versus having somebody sit in the back of a squad car. And so in that situation, it's not just that he's confined, it's that the balancing tests there, you have the government interest and the right to be free from intrusion, and they align more than they do if you put somebody in the back of a squad car. And the third thing I would like to say is, I do not believe that because Trooper Caldwell did not say these were the reasons he put Mr. Stevenson in the back of the squad car were for convenience, just because he didn't say those words doesn't mean that that is not something that is what happened. I think an important point here is that the reasonableness standard, it's an objective standard. And so, you know, Trooper Caldwell may have had his general practices, but when you look at, you know, I think a really important point here is that the Minnesota State Troopers do not have a policy of bringing somebody back into a squad car to be able to evaluate who they are, accurately identify them. That is something that Trooper Caldwell does primarily, as I mentioned in my principal argument, because he had this one encounter with somebody else that made him feel unsafe. And I'm not diminishing the safety risks that an officer has when they do a traffic stop. However, those safety risks under case law have to be particularized to the specific person that they're interacting with. And so when you look objectively whether or not there was reasonableness here or whether or not the trooper's actions were reasonable here, I think that even just based on the Minnesota State Trooper policy, if the sole basis for Trooper Caldwell's actions, taking Mr. Stevenson back into the car, if that's just based on the fact that he doesn't have a license, that is not objectively reasonable. And if the court has no further questions.
I just have a quick question as to the exclusionary rule argument. Have you forfeited that by not raising that in your reply brief?
In terms of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure?
In terms of the argument that you're making now for the first time.
I do not believe that is something that has been forfeit. I think that this court can on its own determine that, you know, look at the procedural posture of this case and decide that this is not something that they can or that this court can address because of the procedural posture of this case, regardless of the fact that I did not address the specific criminal rules of procedure in my reply brief. And I think part of that is that, I think it's important that the state didn't have to agree to this. However, they did, and the only issue on appeal here is the lawfulness of the expansion. However, in terms of what I did argue in my reply brief, I do think that even if the court decides that the rules of criminal procedure argument is forfeit on my part, when you look at the case law around things like inevitable discovery, the important thing here is that what is being discovered, the evidence that is being questioned on if it's admissible or not, is it speculative or not? And there are many cases from this court and the United and other circuit courts that say that, you know, the contents of a statement by its very nature is speculative. Even a slight change in circumstance might influence what statement was made. And I think that the circumstances here of talking to a police officer when you're in your own car versus talking to a police officer when you're in the back of those car, back of their squad car, it is a change in circumstance. And we have no idea what Mr. Stevenson would have said if he had been allowed to remain in his car. And so for that reason, if the court decides to reach the merits of the state's argument on this point, it should conclude that these statements should be suppressed. So we would respectfully ask that this court reverse the district court's pretrial order, and in doing so, reverse my client's conviction. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.